tier series, and especially want to thank Irwin's for helping to sponsor the series on the 100th as well, and for joining up to make sure that we have another 6 installments, and thank you to Rabbi Schaefer.
Thank you. Just to welcome everybody to what I'm calling the spring semester, even though the groundhog has spoken about another 6 weeks of winter, but I always like to look on the bright side. I actually came home when it wasn't dark this evening, so I got very excited about that. So maybe there is an end to the end of the tunnel, light at the end. The topics we're going to do, G through L, I think, is what I set up for this part of the year. I'm really excited about, and I've got to work on it a little bit because I want to talk about Nachum Leibowitz, someone who I had the fortune of learning with for 6 months in Israel. And I spoke about her once, gave a shiur in Fairlawn where we used to live, and the shiur got like 2,500 hits. I mean, it was unbelievable. A number of people in Israel who wanted to hear it. She's certainly an enigma for everybody, and I've got my own sort of take on her, so that's when we get to L. I'm going to, please God, hopefully, all being well, we'll just before Pesach, her Yortzeit is like a week before Yontov. G, which is where we're up to, I decided to get a bit philosophical, because one thing that we haven't done, we've discussed quite a wide range of what I would call sort of ethical dilemmas, business ethics, medical ethics. You know, we've gone through, we spoke at euthanasia, stuff like that. What we haven't done, which is kind of challenging, I have to say, is to talk a little bit about sort of basic Jewish philosophical issues. The existence of God, reward and punishment, free will, which is something that I'll probably say for W because I've already got F covered, so I'm going to have to do W as will, put free next to it. But this one is particularly challenging, the one I'm talking about today. I apologize about the paper. This is a shiur that I prepared a long time ago, 27 years ago, 1990. And it's something that I gave not to an adult group. I think I taught it in a high school. There's a very major high school in London called the Jewish Free School, which has been around for, 120 years. My father went there in his youth, and he lived to be 99. So it's been around a long time, and it's now one of the major Jewish schools in London. And they had a very good 12th and 13th, in England go to 13th grade, 12th and 13th grade program, which I was involved with. And I remember giving this talk to that group at in that program. And I've given it on a number of occasions, but generally not to older groups. And there's a reason for that. And the reason for that is essentially what happened to the Rambam. The Rambam in the year 1220-something, I'm not sure exactly, 1222, 1223, the book, the famous book that the Rambam is well known for, the Mora Nevuchim, the Guide to Perplex, was published. And many people in the Jewish community in Europe took great offense to the Sefer for reasons which are very difficult to understand. But one gets it that he spoke a lot about proofs of the existence of God and went into all of that type of literature, all that type of those ideas. And the Sefer was burnt. It was publicly burnt by the Jewish community. And in the same place in Paris where they burnt it, 20 years later, the non-Jews burnt the Talmud. And that burning of the Talmud was an absolute tragedy because all of those manuscripts, and remember, nothing was printed in those days, it was all written by hand, all lost. And I think there's one manuscript left somewhere in the world which dates back earlier than the 1200s, sat in a museum somewhere, I don't know, last thing I read, I think it was in Leningrad or somewhere like that. It was unbelievable. And many people said, well, once we burn our own books of men like the Rambam, then, you know, Midah Kenegi Midah, this is the way, unfortunately, we are punished by having the most fundamental books that we had at that time, they were all destroyed. And literally, wagon loads of books were destroyed in France in the 1200s. So talking about these ideas of the existence of God is very challenging. And I'll be very honest with you, I'm kind of worried about talking about it because it's one of those things that, I'll do the Tevye approach. What does Tevye do most of the movie? He's talking to God, okay? He's talking to God, but never ever talks about God, Okay, he's always having a conversation with God. These wonderful timeouts that they have in that particular film. Famous stories of people like the Chofetz Chaim used to close his door and have conversations with God in Yiddish. Right? I mean, assuming that God spoke Yiddish, I guess God does speak Yiddish, but this is what was the tradition. And what was so interesting is that people used to listen in. What was he saying? Was there any response? Was there a message coming back? Was it a two-way conversation? And people were very intrigued by all of this. These are traditions which have been around for a very long time. But what is so interesting in the late 20th century, and certainly beginning of the 21st century, is that I would say particularly Orthodoxy has become much more, I'm not going to use the word aggressive, but certainly more self-confident. So when it's coming to this discussion, for instance, of the existence of God, there was, and it's online and you can watch it, there was a debate which Jonathan Sacks held, I think, in London with a gentleman who calls himself the most famous atheist in the world, somebody called Richard Dawkins, who's a British professor, I don't know exactly what he teaches, and there was a debate between the two. And this was online, and it's, again, an interesting thing to watch, going through some of the stuff that we are going to be talking about this evening. And again, you know, that was already a sign of the times that a prominent rabbi would be prepared to go and debate in such a circumstance. It reminds you a little bit of the famous disputations of the 12th century. The Ramban, Nachmanides, had to go through that, not out of choice, but certainly being forced to do so. He won the debate. It was all about whether Jesus is the Messiah, according to the Christian tradition, not according to the Jewish tradition. And the Ramban, Nachmanides, won the debate, and he lost it. They lost the debate because he had to leave Spain. He literally was thrown out of Spain. The king was very, very fey. He said, if I leave you here, they're going to kill you. So you got to leave. And within 4 days, I think, he left and ended up in Eretz Yisrael. He saw it as a sign from God to make Aliyah. So those debates were clearly not debates that people chose to have. But now there is much more an openness to discuss these issues. And amongst Jews who do, from time to time, you know, we all have these questions. I think we sort of rationalize it to the point that we live with the questions. Because there are so many questions that we have. You know, I've got my list of questions after 120 years, things that I really want to find answers to on a personal level, and obviously on the macro level, you know, things that have happened, things that are still happening, right? You know, how this president got to be president, this is something that we need to ask God, because I'm not sure if anyone else can explain it to us. I'm not really sure about it. And things like that. You know, all of these things that are going on all the time. I'm not going to get too political. I'm going to stay away from that. The question here, which people will say to me, why have a discussion about this? Right? I wrote it on the top in Hebrew. Emunatcha balelot. We say the pasuk, we say it very often, your faith is at night. What does it mean? It means that even in the dark, you have faith. In other words, faith is not something that we can necessarily prove, or something that we can necessarily, kick around the ideas, because it's balelot. At the end of the day, blind faith, as we call it, faith should be something which should not be some open to analysis and discussion. Emuna pshuta, this is the expression that people use, simple faith. But the problem with that, of course, is that in the world that we're in, particularly as so many people are exposed to ideas and go to study in very important institutions, Jewish or otherwise, you know, a lot of the kids that I deal with on a daily basis in Colombia, they're in philosophy classes and, you know, discussing all this stuff. So I think it's important that we should also be able to have this discussion and kick around some of the ideas. And the book that I'm referring to here is by somebody called Lawrence Kellerman. Now, he doesn't call himself Lawrence anymore. He's Leib Kellerman, if you know him. He teaches, used to teach at Os Samech. I think he now is around in various places. He comes to the States, but he lives in Israel. And he wrote this book again nearly 30 years ago. Wrote two books, Reason to Believe, which is about belief in God, and another book which is also about belief in Torah, Min HaShemayim, which again is a whole discussion which maybe we'll save for another time. And I'm going to very quickly go through some of the approaches that he brings, just to give you some idea of what he's trying to do. And again, this sefer has a very impressive introduction, a haskoma from Rabbi Volba, who was really one of the great mashgichim, one of the great rabbis in Israel, passed away a number of years ago. who gave him encouragement to do this, because I think Rabbi Volba understood, as does Rabbi Kellerman, that there are many young people out there, the people of the younger generation, who do want to go through the process of trying to understand, can we prove rationally that God exists? And the first thing that Kellerman says in his book is that you're going to be very disappointed when you read this book, because he says there is absolutely no cast iron proof whatsoever. And I was thinking to myself, have I ever met anyone in my life who I can honestly say not only is someone who understands God, but actually can say, b'emunah shelema, as they say, that they know God exists? And I want to tell you this story because this man is remarkable. He's still alive. He's probably now near his 90s. Somebody called Rabbi Sinai Adlin. He's not well known in this country at all. Was someone who gave me smicha and was really very impressive, beyond impressive. His story has been translated from, he wrote his story, what happened to him in the Holocaust. He was taken from Hungary in 1944 and he spent a year in Auschwitz. And he was on the death march when they evacuated Auschwitz. They just had the Holocaust Memorial Day, January 27th, which is the freeing of Auschwitz. This is the date that has been fixed now in many countries, including England. And that story of his, that year that he was in the camp, and then the way that he survived the death march is unbelievable. And every year, he's been making a what he calls a Sudat Hodaya. He makes a meal of thanks to God. Every Parshat Bahar, that was the Parsha when he was liberated, and he tells his story every single year. And he's been doing this since the war. Is now, you know, it's now, what is it, 60 years. Unbelievable. And this is a very, very remarkable man. And I would say about him, and you can read the stories. Actually, the book has been translated by Feldheim, and it's available. Rabbi Sinai Adler. Adler is a name that one recognizes. Sinai makes it stand out. You know, Sinai Adler. The book is definitely worth reading. It's one of those books, maybe you save it for Tisha B'Av, one of those books that you read at that time of the year, but it's really a phenomenal sefer. He made a promise to God. He said, Hashem, if I ever get out of here alive, I will dedicate my life to Torah. That's exactly what he did. He became a Dayan, he became Rosh Yeshiva, he was teaching in the yeshiva where I was learning for many years. My son went there and he was still teaching there. Unbelievable man, and you know, he should be gesund. He's, as I said, he's approaching his 90s.
What was the name of the book?
Again, the book I don't remember, but you have to go by the author, Sinai Adler. It's an unbelievable book, just amazing story. So again, he's a man that I would say, when he says, I believe, ani ma'amin, I feel it. I feel that this person has an absolute awareness and belief in God. There's no question in my mind. But for many people and for many of us, and I'm going to sort of talk about myself, and this is not anything negative, it's just a reality, we have our, let's use the word doubts, our questions. Right? Not that we're doubting the existence of God, but sometimes we have question marks. How can this happen? Right? And particularly something that I'm not going to talk about, but how can bad things happen to good people? This is something which comes back and haunts us over and over and over again. So that's something which, again, I'm just putting to one side. But what I want to do is share with you Kellerman's argument. His argument, his basic argument, is that there are three stages in a person's questioning of belief. He says some people will call themselves believers. All right, and he says that's reaching a certain sort of level of awareness, fine. He says in the middle of what he is defining are agnostics, which he's saying agnostic are people who have the doubts, right? Not sure. Not that they're absolutely sure there isn't, or absolutely sure there is, but they've got question marks. And then finally, the atheist. And the atheist comes from the Greek, he explains the word atheos, theos is God. Means no God. This is someone who stands up and says with absolute clarity and definition that there is no God. And those are very few and far between. And in fact, Kellerman argues that atheism really doesn't make sense because in order to be a true atheist, you will have had to go through every single proof that that the existence of God, we have towards the existence of God in order to disprove it. So there may be atheists in the philosophical world. There are a number of them that are very well known. Certainly in England, there was a guy called Muggeridge. There was another one, forgotten his name. But these were very well known.
Christopher Hitchens.
Hitchens and a number of them who claim to be atheists. And, you know, it's very hard. Are you ever going to change them? Dawkins, at the end of the discussion with Jonathan Sacks, I think they agreed to disagree, if I remember rightly. But it's just interesting to watch because he certainly is a good, you know, put forward some very strong arguments to Dawkins. He certainly made the man think. What I will show in front of you here is essentially the first point which Kellerman makes, which is to say, you know what? If we can get someone from a position of atheism, which is what they think they're at, but it really is not atheism, but it's agnosticism, in other words, they're not sure, then to leap from agnostic to believer is not such a big jump. He says to go from atheist to believer is a very big jump, and most people won't be able to achieve it. But he says if you can land somewhere in the middle, and from the middle jump towards belief, you know what? It's possible. There is reason to believe that someone can believe. Okay, this is his initial argument without going into detail. And again, it's worth reading. This book will take you, essentially takes you about 2 hours to read it, but it takes you about a year in order to digest it, if you see what I mean. This has got a lot of content in it. I'll go through some of the arguments that he brings, which people have said over the years to prove the existence of God. And as I said, this gets very philosophical. You'll probably say by the end of this evening, what did we discuss? What did we do? And you might come out here a bit mystified, but at the end of the day, you know, this is just an exercise in thinking, which is a bit challenging, especially this time of night, but I'll try and make it as interesting as I can. Look at number one. He brings various, what he calls approaches, to try and explain or to justify the existence or the awareness of God. And number one, he says, is the moral approach. And what is the moral approach? He says, and I wrote it over here, he says that everyone agrees that murder is wrong. Okay, I this is the universal ethic which he's putting forward. All right, listen to these arguments because they're an interesting thing. I noted, by the way, that before we get to this moral approach argument, the Yerushalmi interestingly says, and we should know this, that the Yerushalmi is discussing a psukim in the Torah, and it says that there is a pasuk which the Yerushalmi explains that even if you don't have that faith in God, you've abandoned your faith, don't abandon the mitzvot. That's what the Yerushalmi says. The Yerushalmi says that you can still do the mitzvot even if you have questions of faith. Which again is a remarkable statement being said by rabbis of the Jerusalem Talmud, you know, people who were men that we can't really even remotely come to any close understanding of how great these people were, Rabbi Akiva and all the rest of them. And yet, that's what the Jerusalem Talmud says. Jerusalem Talmud says, even if you're not sure, don't stop doing the mitzvot. The word mitzvah comes from the word sevet. Sevet means a team, a connection. Right, you have a team, you connect a whole bunch of people together. A mitzvah is the idea of connection to a higher being. Okay, so by doing the mitzvot, the Talmud is suggesting that is a process. It may take your whole life, and you may not get to the end of the finishing line, as they say, but it's a constant process of connecting the person to Hashem, which, again, is a beautiful idea, which I like very much. Back to the idea of murder. Well, it's a universal ethic to say that murder is wrong, but the question is, why? Why do we all agree? Okay, so again, Kellerman makes you'll see here the different arguments that he makes. The first argument is, it's based on reason. Logic dictates that murder is wrong. It's logical. We know we can't go around murdering each other because society will not work like that, right? It's just not good. Well, we see what's going on in certain cities in America, and we understand this. So the reality of it is that reason may not necessarily be the whole understanding of this, because there will be certain situations where our reason will tell us, you know what, there may be exceptions to the rule. As I said here, if we could, with the benefit of hindsight, take this young Adolf and we know what he's going to become, would we then argue that reason would dictate not to kill the child? I don't know. That's an argument you always have with high schoolers, and it gets very heated. You know, sort of, in the end of the day, maybe the person will do tshuva, he won't become as bad as history proved him to be. But of course, with hindsight, if we know what the person became and what he was, you know, the argument may very well be, from the point of view of logic, that we can make exceptions. Certainly in terms of the death penalty that we impose and capital punishment. So reason may not necessarily be the whole understanding of why we all agree that murder is wrong. All right, I'm just throwing out the idea. So point number two is that if it's not reason that everybody has, then it must be maybe someone decided. Someone came along some point in history, after the cavemen, one assumes, and said murder is wrong. So of course then the question is, who was that person? All right, who made the standard for the whole world? And what happened if that person is no longer alive? What happened after he died? How did it become a universal ethic that everybody agreed to? It's very challenging. All right, so you'll say, all right, so it wasn't one person, it was society that decided. Okay, as I said here, number three, society dictates that it is wrong. Fine, so you're going to say there are certain societies where it won't be wrong, right? I've just mentioned over here, cannibals, I mean, you know, if they still exist, I don't know. Whatever society it is, certain societies may very well decide that murder is acceptable under certain circumstances. So he says, argument number four, that it's unnatural, that it's not a natural state to murder. But he says that sometimes nature is built on the very premise of the larger animals, you know, so surviving by killing the smaller animals. So you'll say to me, murder is unnatural, but maybe that's not true. Whichever way you turn, and again, I'm just throwing out this very, very quickly, because all of this, we can sit and talk about this and thrash it out for a very long time, but I'm just throwing out the ideas to you. All of this shows you that to come to an awareness of why murder is wrong seems very challenging, unless we go for what we're going to read next week, Aseret Dibrot, where it says, Lo tirtzach, do not murder, and we understand that the universal ethic came from the universal creator, okay, the creator of the world, and therefore this became a supernatural initiation, something that came from a source which was above the human experience. And within our world, within our knowledge of what's going on around us, this is something that we all became aware of and that we all are, essentially in the civilized world, let's put it that way, that we're all connected to. This ethic of not murdering. So Rabbi Kellerman argues that may be a very good reason for some people to turn around and say to themselves, well, if this is where it comes from and it's not just based on some sort of, you know, I don't know, sort of airy-fairy idea, but it's coming from a higher source, then we have to say that that gives us reason to believe. Okay, I hope that argument makes sense, because it's kind of difficult to put it over, but this is the point that this is what he calls the moral approach. All right, so again, bear with me. If you've got questions, maybe we'll take questions at the end. I'll just go through some of the arguments, because these are very interesting. Second approach, cosmological approach. And I tell you a little story I wrote here on the page, Mr. Arnold. Mr. Arnold, I don't think he's alive anymore. He was my teacher in high school in England. I went to a school in the centre of London. It wasn't a Jewish school. A lot of Jewish boys there. And Mr. Arnold was the science teacher, but he used to teach astronomy, right? You did an elective, and the elective was astronomy. So it was a bit of fun, and of course he ended up with a few of the Jewish kids in the class. At that time I had a lot of extra studies out of school, and we'd already talked about Breishit in my sort of Hebrew school, and we'd gone through quite great detail. You know, Rabbi Munk in London, who was very well known, was teaching in that school, and he'd given some pretty interesting ideas. And Mr. Arnold really fell into our lap one day by talking about the creation of the world. So I feel very bad even to this day, even though it's like 50 years later. He stood up there and he went through this whole thing, Big Bang Theory, right? This is the way the world created, and he went through it with all of the proofs, etc. And again, if you want to look at Lawrence Kellerman's book, he goes through all of this in much greater detail, because obviously as we've gone on in years, things have become a bit more explained, exploding universe, you know, all these things over here. And I put up my hand, and of course my friend did as well, who was in the same class, and Mr. Arnold said, yes, what do you want to ask? So we both asked the same question at the same time, and poor guy, all the wind went out of his sails. Please, sir, could you tell us, where did the first atom come from? All right, you're so certain that there was an explosion of atoms and the Big Bang Theory. Who made the first atom? And he stopped in his tracks, and I'll never forget it. And the poor guy sort of turned around and said, "Gentlemen," he said, "the chaplain's office is down the hall. Go and ask the chaplain." In other words, as far as he was concerned, his job stopped at the point of explaining the Big Bang Theory, but not necessarily giving us any theological explanation of what went behind the Big Bang Theory. Unbelievable. And I had a feeling that we really should have apologized, because I think the poor gentleman just... he was very gracious. I seem to have a memory that he was okay about it. People look at the world. You look at the universe. You go to the planetariums and, you know, just look at... and it's too much to contemplate, right? The way that the world is... especially when, you know, you go out to the cosmos and all the rest of it. And again, I'm not going to go into the sort of the details, because there's so much detail that Kellerman brings. But again, this, as I said over here, the open created universe offers permission to believe that God set the whole operation in motion. Okay, again, as far as we're concerned, there has to be someone who pressed the button or someone who put the whole thing into action. And for purposes of Emunah, there is certainly a place to sort of look at the world around us and to believe in God. If you turn over, the third approach, which is just the opposite of looking at the cosmos, is start looking with a microscope. And in fact, very, very interesting, there's a rabbi in Brooklyn, some of you may have known him, called Avigdor Miller. I never met him. But Avigdor Miller started writing about this stuff a long, long... You knew him.
Rabbi.
Yeah, a long time ago. His first book, Rejoice, O Youth, which came out in 1963-64, I got it as a prize in Hebrew school. And I read this book, and it just absolutely blew my mind. Number one, there's nothing like it. The only book that was remotely comparable to it was Hirsch's 19 Letters, which also sort of tried to deal with a lot of the philosophical issues.
All the
famous stuff that he wrote about, all the scientific stuff, the leaf, looking at all the... And what he writes... What happened with Rabbi Miller, and I tried to teach this at my summer camp. I go to a camp for... it's the age, the starting age there is 55. Okay, and it goes to 95. It's a remarkable group of people. And when I mentioned Rabbi Miller, they all got very upset. Sorry to tell you, because he wrote stuff on the basis of a lot of his analysis of this type of material, but then he started talking about Holocaust. And he had certain ideas which he was very convinced of, and a lot of people were very upset about what he said. I mean, I don't want to repeat what they said, but they really were not complimentary at all.
What did he say?
Again, he saw evolution as being the reason, one of the evolutionary theories that he put forward, which he disagreed with fundamentally, but he said that became the basis for the Nazis to do what they did, linked one idea to the other, and then gave some very strange connections, very strange ideas. You have to read the book again. I mean, I've got the book at home somewhere. But the book was revolutionary, I have to say. Okay, again, not that I'm so excited with many of the things he says, but the fact that he even was prepared to do that was an incredible thing. All right, Rabbi Miller doing that was something special.
He was
really
one of the first.
First one, absolutely, number one. And to his credit. Now, again, what he talks about, but he doesn't talk about DNA, because in the 1960s they didn't talk about DNA. But Rabbi Kellerman, for instance, in the 1990s did write about DNA. And just by looking at DNA, I mean, you can't watch any American crime show without some sort of DNA discussion going on. It's totally remarkable how DNA works. What was it, Crick? Who were the guys who invented it? I don't remember now the names. Two scientists in England in the 1950s were the first to sort of draw the various diagrams, which and then the now, of course, the genetic engineering is so... it's kind of scary. I mean, this is where we're getting to Brave New World, and we're getting to all of those kind of worrying predictions that we read once upon a time, which are now happening. All right, you know, genetic modifications and all the rest of it. But from the point of view of Emunah, there's no question that when you look at the world and the microcosm of what we're talking about here, this becomes, again, something which is totally amazing. Now, again, I'm glad my wife is here, because in London she worked as a midwife. And she would come home from a birth and say that this was yet another example of a miracle, right? Every time, almost without fail. We take, you know, babies are born the whole time. But the reality of it is, and I didn't realize, for instance, the blood system, right, was going in one direction in the womb, and as soon as the baby is born, the blood flows in the opposite direction. Who knew? And I learned something. And that happens automatically. Automatically. It's unbelievable. And again, all of this is something which, all right, scientists, I suppose, can explain it in whatever way they would, but there's no question about it. This is, if you want to use this as a basis for emunah, there is certainly what to work with. There's no question about it. I just got the quote here from Stephen Hawking, who is now even more famous than he was in this quote in 1988. He says, "The whole history of science has been the gradual realization that events do not happen in an arbitrary manner, but that they reflect a certain underlying order," which for a scientist to say that was quite extraordinary back in 1988. Whether he still agrees with this, you know, this is the guy who talks about the black holes and all the rest of it, whatever that is, I'm not sure. I don't know where he's at the moment. I know that he's not very pro-Israel. That I did read about him, and they made a movie about him not so long ago as well. Whichever approach you want to take, the cosmic approach or the what he calls the teleological approach, good word to know, meaning looking into the DNAs and looking in through your microscope, whichever way you want to understand it, looking at human cells, whichever way you look at this, there is certainly something in which you can find if you're looking to become connected to belief in God. There's certainly areas there which can become very inspiring indeed. The approach which I personally like the most, and from point of view of teaching, so I'm not a science person, I'm sure scientists will like the other approaches. There is a whole organization, the Association of Orthodox Jewish Scientists. I think it's still good. My father-in-law was, he was a member of that, right? And it goes around the world, and they do have meetings from time to time in Eretz Israel, or they have meetings in sometimes here as well, and they've brought out books in over the years of different studies that they've done from religious perspectives. They're a remarkable, really interesting bunch of scientists who are clearly, you know, would understand these points of view. What I want to talk about a little bit is the Jewish history approach. Because this is something which, again, is totally remarkable and something which, when it's pointed out to you, is beyond, to me, this is the ultimate proof. Many people sort of sit there and wonder, looking at Jewish history. I mean, you know, we look at Jewish history, we kind of just, we move on. You know, we sort of, I think because we go over it over and over again, the history, particularly coming now to the Parshiot of Yetzias Mitzrayim, going out of Egypt, we do this over and over again. So we don't sort of look back or look at it objectively and realize what an incredible thing we're actually talking about here. We're talking about a survival of an identity known as Am Yisrael, the Jewish people, over thousands of years of what can only be described as total hatred and oppression where almost wherever we went. And the survival of the Jewish people, and particularly what we have witnessed in this generation, the blessing of the state of Israel, going back to Israel, and not only going back there, but building what has been built, right? And again, at the beginning, the sort of the clearing the swamps, what happened then, but going there now, and we were there a month ago, and just seeing the you know, Israel doesn't sort of stop building a road because there's a mountain, you just build the road through the mountain. It's obvious, right? Nowhere, only in Switzerland, I ever saw such a thing. And it's just beyond belief. Everything that's going on there, everything that's happening, everything that is connected around our history is something which absolutely demands our attention, certainly is something which challenges the rest of the world to give an explanation. People look at it and they say, look, go through, I wrote it on here, this sort of historical timeline. We've got Egypt. We then came to Israel, right? After 40 years of traveling in a desert with no food. All of a sudden, you know, we survived that. And then we come from Israel, we're there for a few hundred years, did not behave ourselves, we went to Babylon, Babel. Okay, and then you've got coming back to Israel again, Second Temple period, which again was another 400 years approximately. And then the Romans turned up, and they took us away. Okay, there, and you go to Rome today, and you see the Arch of Titus, Titus Arch. And one enterprising Israeli got up there, don't ask me how they did it, and they spray-painted Am Yisrael Chai all over it, which I thought, yeah, I don't like graffiti, but that one, yeah, I make a big exception, because that is making a fantastic statement. it was almost the statement which gave me the shivers. I don't know if anyone saw the photo recently that in Berlin, because they'd had this attack, they did an image of an Israeli flag on the famous gate, whatever, Brandenburg Gate. And that image is just, I mean, imagine the same place where they were holding Nazi rallies, and you come back 70, 80 years later, you've got the Israeli flag. The symbol that the Germans used to oppress the Jews is there as a statement that, you know, we are fighting what Israel is fighting, what the world is fighting, Islamic terrorism, etc., etc. It's just that I've kept that as a kind of screensaver, because this is a picture that I just found so, it's beyond belief. And again, go back to the history. So we then went out to Rome and we became slaves over there. Babylon, which we spent 1,000 years in, but everywhere we went, either 500 or 1,000, those numbers are easy to remember. Europe, right? We go to the point of the Inquisition, which another 500 years. We go from 1,000 to 1,500 and we're kicked out of Spain. Okay, I mentioned it a few weeks ago, a guy at work who is, I didn't know remotely whether he was Jewish, he's one of the waiters who works in the catering department in Columbia University. He comes up to me one day and he says, Rabbi, you Ashkenazi or Sephardi? I looked at him, I said, excuse me? I said, Ashkenazi. He said, what are you? He says, well, I'm Sephardi. My family originally comes from Spain. And I said, you're Jewish? He says, well, we sort of are connected. In other words, he's from what we call the Anusim. His family were, you could trace them back to the 1500s. They left Spain and eventually made their way across to, I think, Colombia. And he said there are literally hundreds of people that he knows who are connected to Jewish tradition. They do Friday night candles. They may do some sort of Friday night dinner. Do they go to synagogue at any time? I don't know. I didn't get to that point to ask. I haven't seen him since. It was like Leo Anovi. It was like a strange story, right? Because I knew who he was, and he came up to me and had this very surreal conversation, and then he's gone. I haven't seen him since. But you may come across him at one of your weddings. You know, these waiters are always the same waiters at every wedding. So you may see him. Unbelievable, right? And again, Parsha, you know, then he's asking me, am I Ashkenazi, am I Sephardi? Unbelievable story.
To that point, last year, or the year before, I can't remember, we had a scholar in residence at Bethel, Rabbi Villarreal, same thing. From an Anusim family, discovered that he was actually from an Anusim family when he was only 13.
Yeah.
His father told him that his mom, you know, because they celebrated different things, but they were...
Yeah.
The mother wore a cross.
Yeah,
I mean, they were like...
Yeah,
I'll
tell you the interesting story about that. My sister, who lives in London, from England, a lot of people make their vacation in Spain, and they take a villa, right? A holiday, whatever. So she was in this villa, and next door, the family's name was Levine. So she thought, well, there's Jews living in next door. But she got to the door, and there's a big cross on the door. She opened the door, and she said, you know, introduced herself, said, we're here from London. I see your name is Levine. Are you Jewish? They said, no, of course not. But then they explained, but you know what? Every Friday night in the basement of this house, we light two candles, but we have no idea why. No idea why. Unbelievable. And that was the story, and that's going on, I guess, around... Who knows where, certainly in South America, and who knows what's going on in Spain. It's just remarkable, absolutely remarkable. So again, back to this timeline, and I'm sorry, it looks not done very well. You've got Poland, 1648, so the Tsarist, I mean, I don't even want to talk about it, with the Chomanitsky, Machshamo, and all that whole parsha. You jump from then Polish Jewry for 300 years till you get to the Holocaust. Obviously then we're talking about a third of the whole population of Jews in the world being annihilated. We come 3 years later to the State of Israel, which is again something which is still so new for us, just to get our heads around that concept that after the ashes came the birth from the ashes is remarkable. Five wars in Israel, I mean, we can add to that, you know, this was a few years ago, so maybe there's even, you want to add the Sinai, the Gaza fights as well, and we're still here. After all of this, and not only that, but here we are, and the scary thing is, go to the White House, and they've got, you know, a kosher kitchen over there, because who's running the world? You know, it's really, really frightening. There's a famous story in Germany in the 30s. Two Jews were sitting on a park bench, and one of them was reading the regular paper, getting more and more upset, and the other guy was reading Der Stürmer, the most vile anti-Semitic paper, Jewish guy, and he was smiling. So the guy reading the regular paper looks at the other Jew and he says, Rabbi, what are you reading? Why are you reading it? So he looked to the other guy, he said, listen, you read that paper, it tells you about this economic crisis, it tells you about this country going this way, this country. This paper that I'm reading, the Sturm, tells me that I control the world, tells me I control the banks. What a wonderful news, right? I'm so happy to read this. Very cynical comment, obviously, but he made a point. You know, unfortunately, this is still not going away. It's in now in the Arab world, the disease is there. We know that this is a serious problem, and what are they doing to stem those vile ideas? Not very much. This is something which is very worrying. Mark Twain, here we go, and I'm sure everybody knows this, but let me read it to you. And this is the famous comment of Mark Twain, where he says, "The statistic, if the statistics are right, the Jews constitute but 1% of the human race, probably even less. It suggests a nebulous, dim puff of stardust," this is very Mark Twainish, "lost in the blaze of the Milky Way. Properly, the Jew ought hardly to be heard of, but he is heard of. Had always been heard of. He is as prominent on the planet as any other people. He has made a marvelous fight in this world in all the ages. And he has done it with his hands tied behind him. The Egyptian, the Babylonian, the Persian filled the planet with sound and splendor and faded away. The Greek and the Roman followed, made a vast noise. They are gone. Other peoples have sprung up. Each held their torch high for a time and it's burned out. The Jews saw them all, beat them all, and is now what he always was, exhibiting no decadence, no infirmities of age." Wonderful. "No weakening of his parts, no slowing of his energies, no dulling of his alert and aggressive mind. All things are mortal but the Jew. All other forces pass, but he remains. What is the secret of his immortality?" Question mark. The answer is, says Rabbi Kellerman, and say anyone who sits and thinks about this, the answer is God. If we understand our existence in this kind of way and think about it, It is the ultimate proof of God. There's no other way to explain why we're still here. Why are we here talking about, you know, I always used to say this on Hanukkah, here we are talking about a story of a world which is now a footnote in the library down the road. The Greeks, right? Alexander the Great. I can see lots of books about him. But here I am in a live discussion, talking about a holiday which is connected to the Greeks, and then we talk about Tisha B'Av with the Romans and everything else. These are all amazing people in their day, but they're all gone. And here we are talking about them and giving them, I suppose, a little bit of life, as it were, if you want to call it that. And we're still here. And the answer has to be, if we are still around to tell the tale, it must be because of the existence of God. Rabbi Yaakov Emden, in his introduction to his famous Siddur, he writes there and he says that there's, to him, the greatest miracle in the history of the world is not even the miracles of Yetziat Mitzrayim, which we're reading at the moment. It's not even the miracles of Yoshua, the sun standing still, and everything that we read in the Bible. He says, without question, the miracle, wrote this 300 years ago, without question, the miracle of the existence of the world, the greatest miracle, is the fact we're still here. He, for him, this was ultimate proof of the existence of God. Because there's no other way to explain it. How can we explain it? Not only that we're here, but that we're thriving again. Right? You know, with Nobel Prizes and, you know, all that sort of stuff that we all know about. So, whichever approach you have over here, and I just want to tie this all up. If you want to go back to the moral approach, or you want to do some of the scientific approaches, or you want to go for the Jewish history approach, whichever approach you want to sort of roll into this discussion, whatever it is, it certainly gives one the basis to be able to connect to God, and, as he says over here in his title of his book, gives you permission to believe. He says this is not foolproof. If somebody wants to deny it, and if somebody wants to reject it, it's very hard to argue against that. If it's an emotional feeling, someone feels very detached because of something that happened to them, it's very hard to discuss it. And again, people who come out of the Holocaust and say that they don't believe in God, I've never ever tried to have an argument or discussion on that particular topic with the people who went through those unbelievably horrible experiences, because I wasn't there and they were. And, you know, you've just got to understand, and I do try to understand, that this is something that is almost, you can't argue about. But if we are in a position, hopefully for ourselves, where we can sort of think a little bit about this. As I said, Rambam did it, so I don't feel bad about doing it. I wouldn't do this 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. But if we give ourselves the opportunity to think a little bit about it, then I would like to believe not only are we going to be able to say, well, we talk to God a lot, but a little bit talking about God as well is not such a bad thing. And in the conclusion here, as I wrote, none of the above arguments is 100% conclusive. However, the arguments are surely enough to allow the human being to permission to believe. And look at the Sefer Mitzvos of Maimonides. He says there that our job is ladat, to know God. And end with a little story, something that I experienced twice. I went to the town of Kotsk. Now, the Kotsk Rebbe was very famous. Chassidish Rebbe, who really was a... Again, so many stories about him that I can't even begin to talk about it. But the story goes like this, that there was a... people were asking, what is the difference to have been in Kotsk and with every other Chassidish Rebbe in Poland? And the argument came back, or the word came back, that with every other Rebbe, you would see God, right? You would feel God. In Kotsk, it says you knew there was a God, right? It became knowledge. There was something there. And when you go to Kotsk, you realize this is a tiny town. This is like the size of a few streets in Cherry Hill. I can't tell you how small it is. And out of that came such a dynasty of intellectual thought, what the Kotsk Rebbe wrote and his children, and eventually sort of morphed into a big Hasidut today, Gera Hasidut and various other Hasidim. It's beyond belief. And there was that sense of Lada'at. The Rambam says this, to know God, not just to see, not just to perceive, but to know. And that's the challenge, which I suppose is a lifelong challenge, to get to the point of da'at. Right? Chanenu me'itcha de'a bina v'haska. And I guess that's what we daven for every day. De'a. To have that deep knowledge, that deep connection to God. For some it's easy, for some you go to the kotel and it works. For many of us, I don't think the kotel does it for me personally. Maybe other things do. As I said, watching a baby being born can be who knows what experience, but something happens and penny drops. And it's one of those lifelong things to think about. That was a bit heavy. I apologize. It's a tough presentation because I wanted to get through the different approaches. A lot more to discuss. Next week, a much lighter topic, talking about family, right? But that's also important. Oh, 1 second. No, excuse me. H, happiness. Excuse me. I just read an article about 5 things that people regret before they die. And one of them is dealing with the question of happiness. Very interesting piece. We'll talk about that next week. In the meantime, certainly what to read about, certainly what to think about. Are there any points that people want to raise? Certainly, you can take this page away and sort of think about it, chew it over. It's an interesting thing. Please.
We had another guest speaker. His name is Ari Satcher. He was, I don't know if you know, but he was the scientist behind the Iron Dome.
Ah, yeah.
He did a whole presentation, and he's a rabbi. So he his point was thousands of Scud missiles fell during Saddam Hussein.
Saddam Hussein, 1990s.
And there were no fatalities.
Yeah.
Possible. He went through all these statistical things of what is considered something that could happen. He said, this just doesn't happen.
Doesn't.
It can't happen.
Yeah.
You know, there's only one explanation.
Yeah.
And it makes you believe.
Yeah, yeah. So. And the stories of the Six-Day War and whatever it may be, you know, there is stuff out there. If we want to find it, it's there. And it's important. It's important. Sorry?
He's a rocket scientist.
And he's literally a rocket scientist, yeah, wow. All right, thank you for listening. You're a great audience, as always. Thank you. To Mr. Shen next week, 8:15. Thank you, everybody. Thank you.